with this on. There we go. Almost forgot about this. Okay, so in our previous sessions, we've looked at the biblical model, the biblical creation story, the framework that helps us to understand the universe. And so we looked at evidence for the existence of God, and specifically the God of the Bible, the inspiration of the Bible, and then the guts of what the Bible teaches us about history. And so the next question we want to look at is, can that model, that framework for viewing the universe, can that explain the evidence from science and history? Does it harmonize with the evidence? Can it withstand scrutiny? And can the creation model, as I have described it, be defended as Christians are told to do, 1 Peter 3:15? So in this session, in the session tomorrow morning, I want to answer those questions. And so these sessions will ultimately illuminate why the previous sessions are important to have laid out and have clear in your mind, because they give an underlying framework that will allow you to respond to the critics and the specific questions that are being raised today. So as we look at the attacks being made against creation, then you'll hear me say several times, you'll hear me point back to this model that I've laid out in these previous sessions and giving an answer to the charges. All right, so for this session, we're going to spend some time responding to some of Bill Nye's attacks against creation in this session and the next one, because he does a good job of laying out what some of the major arguments that people are using in this day and age. Raise your hand if you saw the Bill Nye Ken Ham debate a few years ago. Good, several of you did. First half of the debate was okay, but the second half, it kind of went downhill. For whatever reason, Ken Ham did not respond to a lot of the challenges that Bill Nye, the pseudoscientific guy, said. Those were not dealt with, and one of the concerning things about that is that there were many millions of people that saw this debate, and therefore it left the impression as though the biblical creation model cannot answer the challenges that Bill Nye brought out. And so I would suggest to you that the kind of challenges he brought out are going to be used more regularly because the naturalistic side believes that they have some questions that we can't answer. So expect to see those kinds of questions brought out. So we're going to look at several of those that he didn't deal with. And one in particular in this session. So far, Mr. Ham and his worldview, the creation model, does not have this capability. It cannot make predictions and show results. The big thing I want from you, Mr. Ham, is can you come up with something that you can predict? Do you have a creation model that predicts something that'll happen in nature? Okay, so this is a common argument being levied against the biblical creation model today that deserves a response. So the idea is that in science, we make predictions. We're not talking about prophecies. What we mean is, if I develop a theory, I should be able to say, if I'm right about this theory, then if I do this, this will happen. Okay, so if I develop a theory that says the Earth is kind of like a big magnet and it pulls things that don't have as much mass towards it, it just sucks things against it. Okay, if I'm right, then I could take this remote and drop it, and what's going to happen? I can test that. It's going to suck to the Earth, right? Because the Earth is this massive mass. We'll call it gravity, right? So I can test that, and I can make predictions and test it, and it'll verify my prediction or falsify it. So according to Bill Nye, the biblical creation model is not scientific, and it's not valid in that way, because it cannot make predictions that can be verified upon testing this model. All right, so hopefully you've already seen, as I've laid out the creation model, that it's loaded with solid science, with great explanatory power, and is even able to make predictions. In fact, I intentionally used the word prediction several times, throughout those two sessions to give you an idea of just a few of the predictions the creation model has been able to make that fit with the evidence. But I want to take a few other examples to highlight further how the creation model is, in fact, scientific. It can make predictions that have been verified, can be verified in nature. And so I made a list in probably, two or three minutes of 30 different predictions that have been verified with scientific evidence. And I'm not going to go in depth into each one of these. I've got, in fact, the Reason and Revelation issue that I have out there that is available for free if there's any copies left. That is what that issue was over, it includes these 30 predictions as well as the material that I'm going to be covering tomorrow. And you can see that on our website as well for free. Just plug in Bill Nye and look for the article I did on that. Let me just briefly, these first 10 predictions, I actually cover this in my other seminar. We would predict based on the biblical model, matter and energy can't create themselves and they can't be self-existent based on the biblical model. Those have been verified from the first and second laws of thermodynamics. There should be evidence of genetic entropies. The Bible talks about everything deteriorating. Sure enough, that's what we find. Life can't come from non-life because God is the one that creates life. Sure enough, we have the law of biogenesis that substantiates that. We would predict that as we examine life and just the universe at large, we would find characteristics of design since it was designed, right? And we find an infinite number of examples of that. We have a lot of material at AP on that subject. And ironically, even the atheists can't help but admit it. Also, we would expect the universe will exhibit repeated similar designs in different creatures. So for example, if you're an engineer and you design the perfect heart for a creature living in a certain environment, and then you design another creature that's slightly different, but it's going to be in the same relative environment, there's going to be some similarities in that heart, right? So we would expect if you've got the same engineer, there's going to be some similarities in all of the created creatures that are designed for various environments. The evolutionists acknowledge that. In fact, they try to use it as an argument for evolution. It's called homology. They say, well, that means you came from a common ancestor. There's problems with that. We would say the same evidence indicates a common designer. And so they're essentially admitting that that is what we find, repeated similar design. We'd also expect to find that there's going to be a purpose for every organ, everything in your body, and that the idea of a vestigial organ will not be true. So evolution would say, as you're evolving into different creatures, you used to be something different, and you now have organs in you that you don't need anymore, and they just haven't been eliminated yet. They call those vestigial organs. When Weidersheim made his list of 80 or so back in the late 1800s, they thought, ha-ha, we've proven evolution. And we've now found that there's a purpose for everything that was designed in our body, even if we are unknowledgeable enough to even know the extent of how good the usefulness of everything we're finding. This is being proven. We would expect the universe to have an appearance of age. They, of course, have no problem with the idea of age. I think the universe looks old, but we would predict that it should appear old based on what the Bible says happens in Genesis 1. God creates everything just immediately, so it's going to look old. Cause and effect will be proven to be a fundamental characteristic of the universe, implying an ultimate universe cause. And of course, that's the law of cause and effect. We would predict that, and that is even fundamental to what science is. We would also predict that life will produce according to its kind, though variations within a kind can occur, which we define as microevolutionary change. And sure enough, that's what we find. We got all kinds of one of the interesting things, if you study biology, if you just look out at the created order, one of the fundamental characteristics of the earth is God likes variety. You ever notice that? I mean, we don't look like our parents. I mean, there is so much variety. God likes variety. That's an important thing to him. Anyway, we would predict life is going to be producing according to its kind. You're going to sow what you reap, other than maybe variations within a kind, but you're not going to find evidence of land-dwelling creatures evolving into the flying creatures, that sort of thing. All right, so there's kind of the first 10 that I just wanted to go over briefly. So let's go ahead and look more in depth, starting at number 11. So one prediction we would make, since God created all land creatures on the sixth day of creation, and the days were literal days, as I talked about, then humans coexisted with the dinosaurs as opposed to being separated from them by some 63 million years. So we'd predict, therefore, that there would be evidence of that coexistence, even though the dinosaurs are extinct now. So in the same way we would, for example, tell others about something amazing that we witnessed, we would expect such encounters to be passed down in the form of oral stories, books, pictures. You wouldn't necessarily find a lot of fossil evidence of the coexistence after the flood, for example, because fossil-forming phenomena are not, they're very rare except in major catastrophic activity. So during the flood, you're going to find a lot of fossils, but the humans are probably in a totally different habitat from the dinosaurs, so you're not going to probably see evidence of cohabitation in the fossil record with the dinosaurs, of the dinosaurs. But after the flood, so fossil record of any kind of humans and dinosaurs interacting is probably not going to be there, but we would expect these other forms of evidence, oral stories, books, and pictures. Well, sure enough, ancient dinosaur petroglyphs and carvings have been found all over the world that date to times before scientists were even knowing about the existence of dinosaurs, before the term dinosaur had even been coined. So how would the Anasazi Indians from over 700 years ago in Utah have known the anatomy of an apatosaurus? How would they have known what they look like anatomically? Interestingly, apatosaurus fossils were discovered in the area around those petroglyphs a few decades ago, and they're on display in the Dinosaur Museum in Blanding, Utah. In the country of Cambodia, wedged between Vietnam and Thailand, there are many temples that were built between 700 to 1300 AD. The Ta Prohm temple was built in 1186 AD, and many carvings can be seen in the stone of those structures. Several animals are depicted in a column of carvings at Ta Prohm, including this carving. Now, pray tell, what is that supposed to be? It would be hard for a four-year-old to miss what's being depicted in this carving. Again, this is precisely what we would expect if humans saw these creatures, which is predicted by the creation model. In the Havasupai Canyon at the Grand Canyon, you see ancient petroglyphs as well. And notice the carving there in the bottom left of this image. The image looks very much like Edmontosaurus. Notice he's in an upright position, balanced on his tail, indicating that the artist seems to have seen him alive. Again, dinosaur tracks have been found in the surrounding area of this carving. In fact, I dug up several Edmontosaurus fossils out in Wyoming a few years ago, including the upper maxillary, the upper jawbone of an Edmontosaurus out there. In Ica, Peru, we have the discovery of thousands of burial stones from an ancient Indian civilization that thrived hundreds of years ago. Some of the stones portray basic human activity and known human species. Others depict dinosaurs interacting with humans, anatomically correct dinosaurs with, for example, dermal frills, which weren't even reported to exist on the sauropods before the early 1990s, because they would find these plates, but they, since they weren't attached to the spine of these creatures, they would just be laying around, and so they didn't know how they attached. And so you don't even see these popping up in the literature until the 1990s, and yet you've got these ancient burial stones depicting these anatomically correct dinosaurs, which we now understand that's what they would have looked like. In Acambaro, Mexico, you have ancient dinosaur figurines that date to 200 AD and before. At the Carlisle Cathedral in the United Kingdom, there are carvings on the tomb of Bishop Richard Bell, who died in 1496. And again, one that looks astonishingly like a sauropod dinosaur with a long neck, long tail. Many other examples could be given. This one from a 200 AD Roman mural. We go through a lot of this in that book, The Dinosaur Delusion. This one is believed to be all the way back to the period we would say was immediately after the flood. This is a depiction of sauropods on an ancient Mesopotamian cylinder seal. This is a petroglyph from northern Arizona, believed to be 800 years old or so. You have to go on like an overnight hike to see this one, but it's able to be seen as well. They call it Puff the Magic Dragon. So a host of clear-cut, dinosaur-like carvings and figurines, exactly what we would predict if humans and dinosaurs coexisted, at least at the same time, if not in the same habitat. Hard for evolutionists to explain. If humans never saw these magnificent creatures, the go-to explanation is that it's not what it seems. It's a horse or whatever. But that's the best that they've got, even though these sure do seem to be dinosaurs. There's other many examples of controversial human artifacts, like this pickaxe encased in stone. We have a replica of this one at AP. Are these fossilized footprints? What does that look like to you? As a distinct appearance of being a human footprint with the footprint of a theropod dinosaur stepping on it. I saw a cast of this one in Arkansas. So these are artifacts that are argued to have been found in Cretaceous sediment out in Texas. So sediment thought by evolutionists to have been laid down at least 65 million years ago, back when the dinosaurs supposedly lived. So in creationist thinking, this would be towards the end of the flood, when the final layers of sediment were being laid down and the land-dwelling life were being wiped out. So skeptics have to do some gymnastics to try to explain these things, and there are quite a few of these. And they may or may not be what they seem, but we would certainly be able to explain what they are, how they would be what they seem to be, and we'd predict that such artifacts would be found if the creation model is true. Besides petroglyphs and figurines, we have stories that have been passed down through the millennia about these dinosaur-like creatures. And of course, they didn't use the term dinosaur, because that term hadn't even been coined yet. Instead, the go-to term was dragon to describe these dinosaur-like creatures. And of course, embellishments have been made over the years. But if dinosaurs existed with humans at some point in history, you would expect there to be stories about that. And in fact, they're everywhere, across countries, right? It's hard to go into a Chinese or Mexican food restaurant and not see dragon depictions as a part of their ancient history. We know of tales from American Indians with dragons in England, where knights fought the dragons. Sumerian stories from the 3rd millennium BC depict dragon slaying. And so the depictions of the dragons from these stories are very much like what we understand dinosaurs look like. Ancient respected historians give descriptions of dinosaur-like creatures, including the Greek historian Herodotus, Josephus, Marco Polo, and others. Again, this is exactly what we would predict if dinosaurs and humans did, in fact, coexist. And of course, it's also true that the Bible documents historical evidence of the coexistence of humans and what appears to be dinosaur-like creatures in Job 40 and 41, creatures which coexisted with Job, according to Job 40 and verse 15. So recall that starting in chapter 38 of Job, God proceeds to parade before Job many wonders of his creation, humbling Job with the fact that he's not in a position to be questioning God and demanding answers and telling God what he should or shouldn't do. So remember, Job had essentially demanded an explanation from God, thinking that he had been treated unfairly in his suffering. And God's response was, Job, you know, you don't really know what you're talking about. You don't know the first thing about what I do or why I do it. Let me show you what I'm talking about. And then God moves from real-world phenomenon to real-world phenomenon, from real-world creature to real-world creature, real things, not figurative, unreal creatures, but things we actually know exist today or existed in the past and are now extinct. Humbling Job with evidence that proves Job is in no position, knowledge-wise, to question God's actions. And so you'll recall that God's speech culminates with the final two examples of God's awesomeness, the crowning examples of the animal kingdom, which the text calls Behemoth and Leviathan. Behemoth is described as his strength is in his hips, and his power is in his muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs like bars of iron. He's the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he is not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare. And there's a lot of discourse over the identity of this creature, as well as the next one. No one seems to know for certain what they were. Some argue these aren't even real creatures. They're just figurative creatures that God made up. That wouldn't make sense in context, because up to this point in his speech, God has been showing real-world examples to Job. So it seems that it would kind of defeat the purpose to then make up a creature that doesn't even exist. God is trying to overwhelm Job with the things that he has done in the created order. And remember, it says in Job 40:15 that God made Behemoth along with you, meaning in the same way that God made Job, he made Behemoth. He was a real creature. So scholars mystified by what Behemoth was, and notice, in many cases, they're writing and assessing all of this before many of the dinosaurs had even been discovered in the mid to late 1800s, and also trained to believe that dinosaurs and humans did not coexist. So therefore, what would you expect they're going to write? They quickly assume that Behemoth must have been a creature living today, like the hippo or the elephant, and similarly assume Leviathan to be like a crocodile. Again, we look at the actual descriptions, that doesn't match. For example, the elephant doesn't dwell in marshy areas. It needs solid ground. The elephant's strength is not in his hips, verse 16. Instead, it's in his head and neck. He's actually weak in the stomach, not strong, as the text says. Also, recent research indicates that the elephant carries 60% of its weight on its front feet, not his back. So his center of mass is forward in his body, not backward. And ironically, the same study compared elephants with sauropod dinosaurs, so the long-tailed, long-necked dinosaurs, to get a comparison between the two, and discover that the sauropods, contrary to the elephant, had the opposite weight distribution, with the sauropod center of mass being closer to the rear and having much larger hind legs compared to its forelegs. Notice also from the text, Behemoth's bones are like beams of bronze. So I think of these large solid bronze rods. Elephant bones have cavities in them with spongy bone. Hippos have a marrow cavity that makes up 55% of the total thickness of the femur. But the sauropod dinosaurs, again, the ones with the long necks, long tails, had legs and ribs of solid bone, apparently, unlike other animals. The hippo's tail certainly wouldn't be picked out as a highlight for its awesomeness or strength, considering that its tail is essentially a sprig. But the text says Behemoth moves his tail like a cedar, a big tree. Not many animals can be said to have a tail like that. But guess what did? I mean, we know from history now, from the fossil record, there were creatures that had tails literally the size of a cedar tree. Notice also that the text says Behemoth is the first of the ways of God. He's chief in exhibiting the ways of God. Again, I have trouble seeing the hippo as fitting that description, especially when you have more awesome options that this could fit. Well, the crocodile doesn't match the description of Leviathan either. Commentators want to insert the words "look like" all over the place in this narrative. His sneezings flash forth what looks like, they say, light. But the problem is that that kind of terminology is used all over the place throughout this very text when the author intends to do that, but not in all places. So his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. That's true. But his sneezings flash forth light, plain and simple. No like or as included. Burning lights come out and sparks. Not it looks like those things happen, but it does happen. Notice smoke comes out, period. But then a figurative description of that smoke is given, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. See, that part's figurative. Smoke part. His breath kindles coals, period. A flame goes out of his mouth, period. His undersides are like sharp potsherds that spread pointed marks in the mire. This simply doesn't fit the crocodile, whose tracks are smooth, no pointed marks. So it's smooth with a single line down the middle from his tail, not from his belly. Notice the text says, kind of like the comment about Behemoth being the first or chief of the ways of God, on earth there is nothing like him. He beholds every high thing. Okay, now how could a person make a statement and apply that to the crocodile when there are creatures that once existed which fit that description so much better? So in truth, it wouldn't make sense to select these two creatures. They don't seem to fit the narrative as being the crowning examples of God's power and awesomeness. So think about it. Knowing what we do know now about the animal kingdom throughout history, knowing that the evidence that we've already looked at indicates the dinosaurs were around even after the flood at the time of Job, if you, as God, were going to show Job the most humbling examples of the animal kingdom, what would you pick? Well, I tell you, if there's a sauropod dinosaur, I think I'm going to pick that. Someone says, well, wait a minute, how is that possible? I mean, nothing can breathe fire like supposedly Leviathan did. But you might just as easily say, how is it possible that the electric eel can be electric? How can this give up to an 860-volt shock without hurting itself? By the way, how did it evolve that? Or the lightning bug, how is it able to emit its own light? The bombardier beetle, it can create its own chemical reaction internally, bring it to nearly the boiling point of water, and then spray it on a predator without ever hurting itself. How can it do that? Well, we're constantly learning more and more about what's possible in God's creation. Why not the ability to spit out a chemical that ignites when it meets oxygen? You know, if the bombardier beetle can direct a chemical explosion at an enemy. Someone says, well, the hippo and the crocodile, they would have been known to Job in his day. They were in the relative area of the earth there. And so Job would know what God was talking about if he picks the hippo and the crocodile. There's no evidence of the dinosaurs in that area. There just wouldn't be enough vegetation. I mean, you got desert around there. Okay, well, notice there's a lot of assumptions in that argument about all kinds of assumptions. First of all, an assumption about the nature of the area where Job lived in that period of time. Secular scientists have recently acknowledged that the Sahara Desert formed just a few thousand years ago. It was lush prior to that. So when you convert their time frame to the biblical time frame, the formation of the Sahara Desert would correlate to roughly 1500 BC. It's about the time of Moses, well after the time of Job. But it seems to me that the biggest problem with the argument that God couldn't be talking about dinosaurs because Job wouldn't have seen those guys in his area, they're assuming that God was only showing Job things that Job had witnessed. But we know he wasn't. God had already highlighted several things that Job wouldn't have ever witnessed or even known about: the laying of the foundations of the earth, the springs of the sea, the recesses of the deep, Job 38:16. We've only discovered those in the past century or so. The laws of nature are talked about and their governance over the earth, the springs of the sea. Again, how about the law? God just seems to have been picking out awesome features, specific awesome features of the universe, regardless of whether or not Job had even seen these things. So again, we have to ask, why wouldn't God show Job dinosaurs or dinosaur-like creatures in the case of Leviathan if they were in fact living in Job's day, as the evidence we've seen indicates, with humans having seen these creatures and done petroglyphs and burial stones and so forth? So we got evidences of dinosaur-like creatures interacting with humans from all over the world, artifacts, and we've really only looked at a very small sampling. So if this is a fascinating study to you, as I find it to be sure to see our book, The Dinosaur Delusion, for more evidence on that, with references and responses to quibbles that people give in response to that. All right, number 12. If the earth is relatively young and humans lived alongside dinosaurs, then we would predict that there would be evidence the dinosaurs were around in the not-too-distant past. And of course, the evidence we've already looked at indicates ancient humans apparently saw these guys, but on top of that, in the past decade or so, another type of evidence has been piling up as well. Scientists have been cracking open dinosaur fossils that are supposed to be 65 to 150 million years old and discovering collagen and blood vessels with red blood cells intact. We're talking soft, stretchy, flexible tissue has been found in T-Rex fossils, hadrosaurs, mosasaurs, Sitakosaurus fossils, which should have long ago decayed if evolution is true. In fact, we're finding even C14 and trilobites that are hundreds of millions of years old. Collagen and hemoglobin could last undecayed for thousands of years, potentially, if kept cool and dry and sterile, but we wouldn't expect millions of years. And based on this find, it should come as no surprise that C14 is being discovered in these dinosaur fossils as well. And there should be no detectable C14 left if fossils are millions of years old, just due to the nature of carbon dating. So again, this recent discovery verifies the prediction made by the creation model. I think my microphone's starting to go out. I think we may need to do a battery change here. All right, number 13. If the Earth is relatively young, we would predict that geologic processes that are assumed to take eons, like petrification, we would expect we're going to find that they're actually able to occur rapidly, these same processes. And sure enough, more and more scientific evidence is coming to light that verifies that prediction. Scientists have discovered, for example, that the rate of petrification can be significantly altered by, guess what, catastrophic events. For instance, in 2004, five Japanese scientists published their research on rapid petrification in the secular journal Sedimentary Geology. They were studying mineral-rich acidic water from the explosion crater of the Tateyama volcano in central Japan. Water runs over the edge of this volcano as a waterfall. Some wood had fallen in the path of this mineral-rich water, and they found that the wood had petrified within 36 years. And so the scientists decided to conduct further experiments. They found that silica petrification could occur in only 7 years. Also in 2004, a paper was published on rapid silicification of the plants found in Yellowstone. Within 11 months, plants were found to have had enough silicification that the plant tissues had stabilized against collapse and the plant structure was replicated. So again, modern science verifies the creation model predictions. Coal, oil, and diamonds, once thought to take millions of years to form as well, scientists are now having to back away from that and acknowledge they don't necessarily take a long time. Laboratory experiments have verified that coal can form in a matter of minutes, hours, or days if you have the right conditions. Heat being the primary requirement, which remember is an important part of the creation model that I laid out for you in the last session. Volcanic clay accelerates the process along with moderate pressure. Both of those would have been in abundance during the flood. The 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens verifies the fact that catastrophic activity can rapidly create the environment that is necessary for rapid coal production. Again, the modern flood model would have likely brought about the perfect circumstances for this. With oil as well, scientists have discovered it doesn't necessarily take millions of years to form oil. We've been able to do it rapidly in labs, and we're even seeing it in nature. The Guayamas Basin, which is a trench in the Gulf of California, has a 1,500-foot thick layer of material been deposited by billions of tiny organisms. And as hot geothermal waters move through this ooze, the material is being rapidly converted to oil and natural gas. Diamonds are thought to be millions of years old, but scientists regularly are discovering the presence of C14 in diamonds. C14, again, should be completely undetectable in anything thought to be older than even 100,000 years based on the current decay rate of carbon-14. So apparently diamonds aren't as old as scientists have long thought. Apparently something happened within the last few thousand years that sped up their decay rates over a period of time, aging them very rapidly, and not enough time has since passed to allow for the complete decay of the C14 within these diamonds. So diamonds are thousands, not millions of years old. All right, number 14. Again, even if the Earth is relatively young, we would predict that evidence will be uncovered indicating that, for example, the layers of the geologic column can form rapidly as well. So for example, each of those layers, like you go out to Grand Canyon, look at the distinct layers, it's assumed, hey, it takes a long time for that much sediment to be laid down, not even counting the amount of time between those layers. Sometimes they think there's millions of years between the layers that you see. Well, even we're finding evidence now, these layers do not take a long time to lay down. And one such example comes from what's called a polystrate fossil. These are fossils that cut across multiple layers of strata, like this tree or this one. Now, if those layers around these tree trunks take millions of years to form, then just think about what you're saying. You'd have to argue that the tree was sticking out of the ground with its roots dead and lithified for eons without the rest of the tree decaying before it finally had enough time to be covered up with sediment. That is not possible. But if the sediments around this tree were formed rapidly, maybe this tree is in a massive mudslide, right? Some kind of major cataclysmic event involving water and mud moving. Okay, now you can picture this is actually a big mud layer that is moving along during the flood and then deposits these, and so you end up having a fossil cutting through several layers here. And so besides trees, calamites have been found as polystrate fossils. Catfish have been uncovered. Here's perhaps the most famous of polystrate fossils, an 80-foot-long baleen whale standing on end in a diatomaceous earth quarry in California. So just one example of a polystrate fossil refutes the claim that sediment layers take millions of years to form and lithify. All right, number 15, secular geologists argue that uniformitarianism is true, although, again, there is some movement away from that. But the minute you do that, you have to throw out all the evolutionary dating techniques. They're all based on uniformitarianism. And so those techniques, are the primary evidence that is used to try to prove an old Earth. According to uniformitarianism, processes going on today have always been going on in essentially the same way. So if a stream is going through a canyon, slowly removing its sediment, it's assumed it's always done that in that same slow way. So you want to know how old a canyon is, you just add up how much sediment had to be removed at today's current rates. If the creation model is true, we'd predict that canyons can form rapidly, and then in the past there have been events that would have caused rapid erosion. And sure enough, we find evidence substantiating that prediction. For example, March 19, 1982, a small eruption at the summit of Mount St. Helens caused a massive mud flow. Within one day, a 20-mile-long, 140-foot-deep canyon was carved, shown here on the screen. This occurrence completely destroys uniformitarianism. If uniformitarianism is true, you look at this little stream going through this canyon, and you assume, hey, this little stream is going to gradually carve this out at the rate it's doing it today. It would have taken tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years for this little canyon to form. It was formed in one day. It's been called the Little Grand Canyon because it appears to be a 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon. I mentioned the Lake Missoula flood, well-documented flood from the Ice Age. Water breached an ice dam and 500 cubic miles of water were released. That's 10 times the combined flow of all the rivers in the world were released in 2 days. It destroyed 16,000 square miles of terrain. It cut hundreds of feet through solid rock. It created canyons, carving 50 cubic miles of earth. All right, number 16, if the earth is relatively young, but evolutionary dating techniques say it's old, then we'd predict that evidence would come forth indicating that the evolutionary dating techniques must have flawed assumptions. And sure enough, that evidence is becoming more and more readily available. Evolutionary dating techniques are built upon at least three fundamental assumptions that have major problems, and I go into this more in depth in my evolution seminar, but each of these can be shown to be unreasonable, and there's a great book called The Young Earth by John Morris and Frank Sherwin that we sell that provides modern scientific evidence of what I'm claiming. But for the sake of time, let's look briefly at some recent news which highlights why this first assumption is wrong. In 2009, CERN, that's the European Organization for Nuclear Research, this is where the Large Hadron Collider is, that discovered the Higgs boson particle, the God particle. You remember when that happened? They announced research that indicates that the nuclear decay rates are not, in fact, always constant. They discovered that the decay rate of thorium-228, if it's in water, it increased by a factor of 10,000 as a result of ultrasonic cavitation. Well, guess what kind of scenario would be perfect for speeding up the decay rate of thorium-228? The flood. How about in 2010, a research team from Purdue, they released research where they had discovered that the radioactive decay rates, in fact, vary with the sun's rotation. All right, now notice, without this fundamental assumption about constant nuclear decay rates in place, okay, the idea is you've got this kind of element over here. It gradually changes into this element over time. It decays down into this. They assume it's a constant decay rate. So therefore, if you find a rock that has, say, 90% of this new kind, this new element left, and 10% of the other kind, and they extrapolate backwards and they find the age of the rock, well, that's assuming constant decay rate. This is a major assumption that, again, it's a uniformitarian mindset. But what we're finding is that decay rate is not constant when we actually look at the physical evidence. Without this fundamental assumption about constant nuclear decay rates in place, the radiometric dating techniques can't be used to get the age of anything that's very old with any certainty. And the primary evidence for an old Earth just shatters. So again, the creation model predicted the decay rates are not constant. And sure enough, science has confirmed that. Number 17, if the Bible indicates the earth is relatively young, then the creation model would predict that evidence of that claim would surface. And it has. Many different lines of evidence point to a young earth. Here's just a handful of those. Again, that book, The Young Earth, is good at laying out a lot of these. The moon is receding from the earth. It's moving away from the earth at a rate of about 4 centimeters per year at present. The recession isn't a linear recession, so when it was closer to the Earth, the recession would have been faster. Based on the equation that describes the recession rate, scientists can calculate where the moon would have been compared to the Earth at different times. And so we know, for example, 6,000 years ago, the moon would have been about 800 feet closer to the Earth than it is now. And that'd be fine, not a problem. But there is a problem if you say the moon is as old as they say it is. Evolutionists claim that the moon is 4.5 billion years old. Okay, so you got to think as a uniformitarian. That's what they're going to be using for their dating techniques. Using today's rates, 1.5 billion years ago, the moon would have actually been touching the Earth. So it would have been physically impossible for it to be any older than that. So they would have to explain this away by claiming, well, the recession rate must have been different in the past. But notice that's now giving up on the uniformitarian assumption, which is necessary for the old age. So the uniformitarian assumption is what is used to give them the old ages they need for evolution. Without the uniformitarian assumption, then their proclaimed evidence for an old age of the Earth vanishes. So bottom line, the moon can't be as old as they claim using their own assumptions. But a 6,000 to 8,000-year-old moon, not a problem. That's predicted by the creation model. It fits comfortably with the evidence. Here's another example in the area of population statistics. Evolutionists believe humans have been on the Earth for some 2 to 3 million years, the genus Homo, that is. So all of the species that fall into Homo, the genus Homo. Using statistical equations, we can get an estimate of how many people should have been on the Earth if that were true. So given conservative estimates, if you account for disease, war, famine, and so forth, and if you just assume humans have been on the Earth for 1 million years rather than 2 to 3 million years, there should be 10 to the 2,000 people on the Earth today. That's a big number, right? I mean, can you even fathom that number? To try to grasp the number, consider that the known universe is 28 billion light years in diameter. So if you took miniature humans that are 3 feet tall, narrow shoulders, squeeze them into the universe like sardines, you could only squeeze 10 to the 82nd power people into the whole universe. All right, now notice that leaves a few more humans, right? In fact, a ridiculous number of humans, enough to completely pack 10 to the 1,918 other universes like ours, to completely fill up that many more universes. And remember, these are calculations based on humans just being around 1 million years, not 2 to 3 million years like they're supposing. Okay, so if they argue, well, there just couldn't be that many people. There's just a lack of resources. And so all of those extra people would simply die off somewhere around 50 billion, which is what they say Earth's capacity is. Well, then there should be evidence that that capacity was reached many times long ago. And so there should be billions upon billions of hominid fossils proving that contention, and yet they admit we've got enough to basically fill one coffin. Okay, so there's no evidence that the human population has ever been anywhere near capacity. It's just not reasonable, the mathematical gymnastics that have to be done to try to make this work. But again, interestingly, if you adjust the calculations based on our model, the biblical creation model being true, we'd argue about 4,300 years ago, 6 people began to repopulate the earth if you leave Noah and his wife out, and therefore there should be about 6.7 billion people on the planet today, which of course is pretty close to what we see. Another example, scientists have been measuring the earth's magnetic field with precision since about 1835. They've determined that the earth's magnetic field is decaying, and it has a half-life of about 1,400 years. So again, we use their own assumption of uniformitarianism, and we start calculating back in time. You double the Earth's magnetic field intensity every 1,400 years. You get to a point only 100,000 years ago when the magnetic field would have been so strong that the Earth's field would have been comparable to that of a neutron star, creating immense heat that would have been catastrophic to the Earth. Earth's internal structure likely couldn't have even sustained the immense heat. It'd be impossible for life to be able to exist 100,000 years ago. And yet evolutionists say life has been around for 3.8 billion years on Earth. So if the Earth is as young as the creation model says, this is not a problem. There's no problem to even dodge here, no big deal. Another example, scientists know that helium is accumulating in the Earth's atmosphere, and they know how much helium's there. They know the rate at which helium is accumulating in the atmosphere. So using their own assumptions, again, it's easy to calculate the upper limit for how old the atmosphere could be. And we find that it could not be older than 2 million years. Now, it doesn't give you the actual age. It just gives you an upper limit, which is a limit way under what evolutionists need it to be in order for Earth to be the way it is. So using their own assumptions, the Earth cannot, as they proclaim, the creation model would predict a young atmosphere, and the helium content in the atmosphere verifies that prediction. So several other scientific techniques are available which verify the creation model predictions for the young age of the Earth, and yet you don't hear much about these, especially young people in science classes. They're not highlighted. For the sake of time, we'll go ahead and move forward. Again, I point you to The Young Earth for a lot more of that book on more evidence on the young Earth. All right, number 18. Evolution predicts that life has evolved into more complex forms of life, and intelligence has gradually increased over time, starting with a single-celled organism and ending with the state of consciousness that humans enjoy. Ancient man, of course, is depicted as being dumb cavemen, grunting and beating things with clubs, incapable of intelligent thought. I know some of us are still like that. That's true. So really only developing more sophisticated technology as our brains evolve enough to allow us to. The creation model would actually predict the opposite, that God made man fully formed and perfect. His brain, his genome was in pristine condition without any genetic defect and mutation. His ability to think and reason would have exceeded our own. So man, before the flood, could have been capable of amazing feats because humans lived hundreds of years in addition to that. The Bible verifies that humans were already intelligent at the very beginning, indicating that cities were being built by the time of Adam's grandson. Also, apparently, during the lifetime of Adam, men had already begun using tents, having livestock, playing musical instruments, and even working with bronze and iron. And these are practices that are thought to have taken hundreds of thousands of years to develop. So the evolutionary model would predict a continual increase in human advancement and intelligence and enlightenment as humans evolve. The creation model would predict that advancement doesn't as much have to do with intelligence as much as it does, number one, entropy, So as the human genome continues to degenerate over time, our bodies and brains are simply not capable of doing what they were capable of doing 6,000 years ago. So we'd predict a gradual decline in various aspects of our human abilities. So, but also number two, we'd predict that human advancement has to do with the state of a society, okay? The decisions that its leaders are making, whether the society creates an atmosphere that encourages learning and research and exploration, because that's what we're designed by God to do. How free a society is to exercise its God-given talents. And of course, whether or not that society is behaving in a way that grants it providential blessings from God. Don't you think that's important in whether or not a society succeeds? Sure, from the biblical perspective, it would be. So advancement would be up and down at different levels throughout history. And of course, when a society collapses, you'd expect much of that advancement to just come to a halt and many times disappear. The Bible even describes that over and over. Societies that would just become a byword. They wouldn't even be known anymore. They just disappear. Civilization's just gone. And sure enough, the more archaeologists dig around, the more amazing things are discovered that prove the great intelligence of ancient man. They found amazing architecture and structures that many times are still a mystery as to how the ancients were even able to create them. Archaeologists have uncovered evidence of advanced ancient human intelligence in countries all over the world, ancient boats able to hold many people, precise maps, advanced astronomy, even though they didn't have the kind of telescopes we have, advanced chemistry, hydraulic engineering, and weaponry. Solid evidence indicates that the Nazca people of Peru, who were flourishing between 100 BC and 800 AD, were able to perform successful skull surgery to relieve pressure on the brain from battle wounds. They also were able to build a sophisticated system of aqueducts, many of which are still functioning today, called Puquios. Ancient towers, ziggurats, and pyramids have been found all over the world. Abilities which societies had and then technology often disappeared with the collapse of that society, only to be uncovered by archaeologists hundreds or thousands of years later. The Nazcan people, again flourishing some 2,000 years ago, were able to draw enormous, precise pictures like these on the ground. Okay, so notice these span huge spaces. These little lines are roads. Okay, so these are enormous. Okay, some of these pictures are so enormous that we didn't even discover them until we could fly over them. And yet these people were making these precise portraits 2,000 years ago. In the 1930s, archaeologists discovered ancient batteries, proving that people in Baghdad knew how to make these as early as 250 BC. In 2006, the New York Times ran a piece announcing the discovery of ancient Peruvian canals that are used for irrigation farming. These are thought to be 4,000 to 5,000 years old. We're talking, this goes back to the time of Moses and even Abraham. Craig Morris of the American Museum of Natural History, he said, their use of slope and management of water flow shows again that ancient people were a lot smarter and more observant than we often give them credit for. Humans have always been intelligent. And again, the creation model would predict that that would have always been the case even in ancient times. Now, it's true that we have a lot of advanced technology today, but don't let that fool you what's really going on there. That doesn't mean that humans have gotten smarter. The primary discoveries that have caused the technological boom that we've seen in the last century, think about electricity and the internal combustion engine and airplanes and telephones and computers, these can be traced back, in general, to individuals who either accidentally stumbled across a discovery or designed something after many, many, many trial and errors. It wasn't about humans just being more evolved. Now, after we figure something out, discover something, humans are really good at building on that discovery and inventing new things from that. But that initial discovery is crucial. And we have more people on the planet today doing this kind of research. We have more communication between the countries than in the past that allows that progress to ensue. But the primary discoveries themselves that caused it, that sparked the technological rising of the last century, are often just lucky breaks, or as we might say it biblically, providential blessings. So if the pre-flood world had stumbled across electricity, I could only imagine what they would have been capable of doing with that knowledge. You know, keep in mind, they're living 900 years. Imagine what you could do in your trade, whatever it is, if your body could work well for 700 or 800 years. Imagine that. You might be able to build an ark in that amount of time. You know, you might learn some cool things. All right, number 19. Since the Bible mentions giant humans, we'd predict there might be evidence surface that supports that claim. This is a fun one. Are giants a mythical idea? Apparently not, according to evolutionists. The popular science podcast, The Naked Scientist, yes, that's weird. Cambridge University puts this out. They conducted an interview with Lee Berger in 2007. He's the paleoanthropologist in the news a lot over the last few years. University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. He's the guy that discovered Australopithecus sediba, Homo naledi. So the group had an opportunity to go visit his fossil collection at the university where he is a professor, and they discussed the fossils at his museum. In the article following the interview, Chris Smith, the editor, said this: "One of the most interesting things that the fossil record reveals is that we went through a period of extreme giantism. These were people routinely over 7 feet tall. They were huge." All right, so Berger says, you probably heard the myth that ancient humans were tiny, and some of them were tiny. But as we move through the period of 0.5 million to 300,000 years ago in Africa, this is basically post-flood, before Abraham, they go through a period of giantism. He then proceeded to show the group an example of one of the giant femurs from a species dubbed Homo heidelbergensis. Berger says, they are huge. That's so big we can't even calculate how big this individual was. You need an NBA basketball player to get someone of the height someone like this would have been, something like over 7 feet tall. So these are enormous fossils. They can't even really tell how large the person would be that had these bones. He just surmises over 7 feet tall because they don't have a full skeleton. Smith responds to Berger and asks him, if this extreme size, could this just be an abnormality? Okay, Berger says, no, because we found a lot of them. Everywhere we find them enormous. These are what we call archaic Homo sapiens. Some people refer to them as Homo heidelbergensis. These individuals are extraordinary. They are giants. Okay, so notice, first of all, he acknowledges that they're humans. They're actually Homo sapiens. Okay, even though they're ancient, but they're just enormous. They're giant-like, and it's not an abnormality. There seems to be a race of these guys. And if Homo heidelbergensis isn't big enough for you, back in 1944, Rolf von Koenigswald Netherlands Indies Geological Survey, he found some enormous jaw bones. Time magazine ran an article announcing the discovery. Notice the title of this article: Giants in Those Days, quoting from Genesis 6 and verse 4. Koenigswald first found a big jawbone which looked more human than Pithecanthropus's, but was so massive that he thought it could not possibly be a man's. Then he found a still larger jaw, the biggest ever discovered, which was unmistakably human. It was apparently the most primitive, truly human fossil ever discovered. Koenigswald named it Meganthropus paleojavanicus. How about that for a name? All right, and that wasn't the end. Koenigswald's crowning find dwarfed even Meganthropus. He found three astounding teeth. They were 6 times as big as a modern man's molars. Weidenreich is sure from the pattern of their biting surfaces that they are definitely human. So evidence of enormous humans. He has named this monster Gigantanthropus. Weidenreich now believes that gigantism and massiveness may have been a general or at least widespread character of early mankind. So evidence of these enormous humans. Now, it's possible that these aren't all references to the giants like Goliath. I would hypothesize that the ancient world, especially the pre-flood environment, might have been more conducive to a larger size all around, not just the animals and plants that we're finding that are enormous, but humans too, in a more widespread way, which is what Weidenreich is suggesting. You know, maybe, maybe not. But notice again, we have scientific evidence that verifies the Bible's claim that there have been enormous humans in the past. And if the fossil evidence isn't enough, of course, you can look around today and see examples of extremely large people, can't you? Even though we're now thousands of years beyond the optimal period of human health and longevity of life. I think of the professional wrestler Andre the Giant, died in 1993. He was just 7 feet 4 inches. He was a shorty compared to the tallest man alive today, Sultan Kosen, who's 8 feet 1 inch tall. His immense height seems to have come as a result of a pituitary condition, which resulted in an overproduction of growth hormone. And according to the Guinness Book of World Records, the tallest man in medical history that has been reliably confirmed was Robert Vodlow, died in 1940, measuring in at 8 feet 11 inches. So just shy of 9 feet tall, weighed 491 pounds at one point. So the giants of the Bible were not mythical beings, they're just humans, big ones. Big humans. Number 20, if the flood happened, we would predict that stories from such a cataclysmic event would surely be preserved as ancient oral traditions or in writings, since the flood would have been before the time when apparently writing was even occurring. The stories would have initially been passed down, how? By word of mouth. And so you'd expect similarities between stories, but you wouldn't expect them to be exactly the same. And likely many distortions and adjustments would have been made over the millennia. Well, sure enough, there are over 250 legends about a great flood. Here's just a few of them. Out of Greece, Zeus wanted to destroy humans with a flood and start over. Deucalion and his wife are put in a large wooden chest, and then a flood covered almost all of the mountain peaks. In Babylon, Utnapishtim is warned by a god to build a boat in preparation for a terrible flood. He covered it with pitch. He brought animals of all kinds and provisions, sent out a dove to see if the flood had receded, then a swallow, then a raven, which didn't return. They then left the boat and worshipped their gods. The Toltec Indians tell of a great flood that destroyed the first world. Notice, very specific, 1,716 years after creation. Very close to the Hebrew text on that. A few people escaped in a closed chest. When I was in at Grand Canyon, I also heard of a flood legend of the Anasazi Indians out there in western the United States. They have their own flood legend. In China, the Nasu people, God sent a messenger to tell three sons of a flood. Dumb, ironically, listened and built a wooden boat. And then a huge flood covered the whole earth, and Dumb, ironically, was saved and had three sons that then repopulated the earth. So amazing similarities. They don't match the Bible, the biblical model perfectly, but if they did match, you'd suspect that there'd been some kind of collusion. So in the books, The Discovery of Genesis and Genesis and the Mystery Confucius Couldn't Solve, Nelson even argues that the origin of the Chinese word for boat is comprised of the ancient forms of the words for vessel, eight, and mouth, or people. So he makes a case for several other Chinese words being traced back to the flood and the Tower of Babel and even creation, and also argues from historical evidence that the Chinese were actually originally monotheistic. Again, there are over 200, which, by the way, every society would ultimately originally be monotheistic, right? That's where it starts. So again, there's over 250 legends of a major flood, and the resemblances to Scripture in many cases is notable, just as we would predict to be the case if the flood actually occurred. All right, so let's keep on moving here. Let's look at 22, evidence that catastrophism, rapid burial, explains much of the geologic column, especially the fossils, that this will be discovered. We've already seen examples of polystrate fossils, but then you also have these dinosaur graveyards that are found all over the world. These are pictures from the dinosaur graveyard in Wyoming, where I was doing dinosaur fossil excavation. This is one of the quarries we're digging in. Over 18,000 dinosaur fossils have been dug up so far. They're all over the place. These are just some of the plates, some of them. How about this? Many fossils show evidence of rapid burial catastrophism, as would be predicted if the flood occurred. Notice this fish is in the middle of his dinner. And this ichthyosaur is in the middle of giving birth. Got to see this at the in the British Museum of Natural History. So something catastrophic buried these guys. And this is what the fossil record looks like. It's catastrophic activity that's generally behind what creates fossils. These dinosaur fossils show a typical posture that dinosaur fossils are found in when you find the entire creature articulated like this and hasn't been destroyed, which is usually what you find. In these cases, they're found pristine like this, and they're in this death pose, found in sediments deposited by water. Their heads are thrown back, their tails are curved forward, and many times their mouths are open as though they're drowning. And this posture is called the opisthotonic death posture, and it's understood to be due to death by water. This is a picture of a fossilized clam bed that Kurt Wise and I discovered while studying late flood sediment in Wyoming. The clams are fossilized, many of them in a closed position, indicating catastrophic burial, and this is common as well. Clams are known to open when they die in natural settings, and we've got so many fossils proving catastrophic burial. All right. The fossil record should reveal fully functional, distinct creatures when they appear in the fossil record. So no evolutionary history. This is something we would predict based on the biblical model. And this prediction has been verified beyond a shadow of a doubt in the fossil record. And it's even conceded by the secular community. When you look at the geologic column and you start at the bottom of where the fossils show up, and you go even before that. So you go all the way down to the bottom of the geologic column, and then you start moving up closer to history. You're going along, you don't find anything, and all of a sudden, you hit this line, and then across the world, you have this explosion of fossils, already fully formed without any evolutionary history. And they give it a name, the Cambrian Explosion. These are creatures already fully formed without any evolutionary history. Notice what famous evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins said about this. The Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage about 600 million years, are the oldest in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups. And we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. It's as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. Okay, why? Because that's exactly what we would predict to be the case. This is another prediction borne out. Not good news if you're an evolutionist, but evidence perfectly in harmony with the biblical creation model. Atheistic evolutionist Blair Scott, communications director for American Atheists at the time, was in a debate with Kyle Butt, who works for us at Apologetics Press. He says, if I take the Cambrian explosion on its own, the logical conclusion I would draw is, wow, it was created. All right, this is proof positive of the creation model. All right, he goes on and says, the problem is there's all this other evidence around it that creationists ignore. All right, now wait a minute. What evidence is he talking about? Well, all of the evidences that we address in our materials, one after the other, and dismantle it. Okay, so after you deal with that evidence, what are you left with? It was created based on his own words. That's what you have whenever you look at the Cambrian explosion. It is proof positive of the biblical creation model. All right, numbers 24 and 25 on that list. Evolutionary theory would predict that fossils in the lower strata, and as you go down, it should get simpler, closer to the single-celled organism that everything supposedly came from. Trilobites are considered representative of the Cambrian strata, where the Cambrian explosion is, right? And then as you move higher in the column, the fossils should be becoming more complex as life evolves towards human beings. In the Bill Nye Kinham debate, Bill Nye even argued, you never see the more complex higher organisms mixing with the lower organisms. And if you did, he said, you could change the world because you would disprove Darwinian evolution. Well, the truth is, the trilobite isn't even a lower animal. It's not simple, as evolutionary theory would predict. It's considered one of the very first creatures to have evolved because it's down there at the very bottom, and therefore it's predicted to be extremely simple, but the more we've looked at it, the more we find it's extremely complex. The eye of the trilobite is equipped with aplanatic lenses, dual lenses, as opposed to the human eye, which is equipped with just a single refractive lens. Scientists acknowledge the design of the trilobite's eye is better than any other eye design, and yet it shows up at the beginning. Again, the trilobite is supposed to be primitive and simple. It's not. The trilobite is evidence against evolution. But even if we acknowledge the trilobites were primitive, it's also not true that you don't see what they would consider to be higher and lower animals mixing. We got several examples of strange anomalies where you've got artifacts that have been found that shouldn't be where they are found. And so they're very controversial, to say the least, in many cases, even among creationists. And many would brush these examples aside as not what they would seem. As just one example, consider this Meister footprint, what appears to be a fossilized sandal print with a trilobite in it. It's disputed by some who say, again, it's not what it seems, but it's exactly what we'd predict to be the case if the creation model is true. We've got human-like footprints in coal veins that are supposed to have been laid down 248 million years before humans were around. You got that human pickaxe found in ancient sediment that I showed you earlier. How about this fossil of a mammal with a dinosaur in its stomach? Okay, mammals like this aren't supposed to be around with the dinosaurs. That's kind of a problem. Or the existence of so-called living fossils like the coelacanth, creatures that were thought to be ancient, extinct creatures which evolved into stuff more complex. They're lower in the fossil record, but they kind of disappear from the fossil record, so they assume they went extinct, and then all of a sudden they find one alive. So this proves that just because you don't see fossils of certain creatures in any place in the geologic record, it doesn't mean the creature didn't continue to exist during that time period and maybe is still alive today. So the evolutionary model is going to struggle with these anomalies because they contradict the predictions of evolution, but they're actually predicted by the creation model. You know, we would argue that just because something's lower in the column, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's more primitive or simple. There's many different things that could be going on there, but the main thing to keep in mind is, based on the catastrophic plate tectonics model that I showed you earlier today, if the bulk of the water is coming from the ocean, as the water and sediment is coming up and coming closer and closer to land, what is going to be buried first? Okay, marine creatures are going to be hit first. You'd expect them to be at the bottom of the geologic column. And then you're going to be gradually moving closer and closer to the land. So you're going to find creatures that are buried along the coastlines. And then you move a little further inland. You're going to find the creatures that are a little further inland. And then as you move further away from the ocean, you're going to find differences in habitats. So the geologic record is actually more of a record of the burial process during the flood. All right? This is all just, again, it's not a record of how these creatures lived, it's a record of how they died. It's always the opposite with the creation model, just about, it's the opposite of what the secular guys are assuming. We would say the reason why there's generally major, you don't see a lot of mingling between the different levels is because these creatures lived in different habitats. And the fossil record ends up being a record of the successive burial of these habitats with exceptions. Every now and then there's a funny exception. You've got a creature that's out of place. That would be expected too. You've got creatures that are running away from some kind of mudslide. You find them all of a sudden piled up in one place. You got this massive graveyard of creatures as though they ran out of places to run. And there might be a funny mixture of fossils there. We find that. We find that kind of thing. But in general, you have this general pattern that you see in the geologic record that fits the flood model. Fossil graveyards are clear examples of places where herds of animals were caught and unable to escape a cataclysmic fossil-forming event. Number 27, sedimentary rock is understood by geologists to usually be found formed within bodies of water. So if the flood occurred, you'd expect that sedimentary rocks would be prevalent on the earth, and they are. In fact, they're the most common rocks that are exposed on the surface of the earth. They make up 75% of the surface rocks. You even find them on mountains. Number 28, seismites are likely going to be found if the flood, and specifically catastrophic plate tectonics, is true. This is the work that I did out in Wyoming showed a lot of this. The idea is that if you were to Let's say you're standing on a seashore, and you're standing in some sand, and the sand's got some water in it. If you were to kind of jump on that sand and compact it, the water within the sand is going to come up. It's going to come up out of that, and you're going to be left with this compressed sand. If you were to then take that sand and dry it out, and if it became lithified, turned to stone, and you were to cut it in half and look at a cross-section of it, you're going to find the path that the water took in escaping. You call this fluid avulsion structures, and so you find, if you've got an earthquake and you've got sediment like that that's been wet, when the earthquake hits, it'll send a shockwave through this wet sand and create what's called a seismite that's loaded with these fluid avulsion structures, little squiggly lines. So when we find these seismites today, they're usually a few inches, like Alaska 1964 earthquake, somewhere around 9.0 on the Richter scale, formed seismite, relatively small, few inches thick seismite. And so this is something geologists are discovering today. Now, out in Wyoming, we're digging down and finding seismites that are not just a few inches. They're meters. They're huge. Unheard of. We don't even know what kind of earthquakes would be necessary to create these seismites. They're unearthly. We're talking, you have to picture something like, say, oh, I don't know, an oceanic plate smashing into a continental plate forming the Rocky Mountains. Something like that would do it. It's exactly what we'd predict if catastrophic plate tectonics happened. Enormous seismites that are 15 feet or more in height. Yeah, so that's me right there, right? This is a massive seismite. So all of the material that was around it is eroded, probably maybe during the recession period of the flood, and left evidence of these enormous, enormous earthquakes, probably in the formation of the Rockies. Again, we'd predict seismites would be found, and sure enough, they are. Numbers 29 and 30, as we start wrapping it up here. If the creation model is true, and the incident at the Tower of Babel is true, then we would expect there to be evidence that that event happened through, for example, again, stories that were passed down through the millennia, just like with the flood and with the existence of the dinosaurs. And sure enough, recall the flood legend of the Toltec Indians, and the legend after the survivors left the chest, they wandered the earth until they found a place to build a zaqali, a high tower, in case another flood came. And during that time period, their languages were confused, and they spread out over the earth. The Miao Tzu people of China and their flood story, it poured for 40 days. Then there was 55 days of drizzle. The water covered the mountain ranges. Then Nuwa and his family and animals were saved in a wide boat. A bird was sent out. There were sacrifices. Okay, then the survivors made cities, spoke the same language. Then they built a very high tower, which was wrong. God mixed the languages. They didn't finish the city and tower. They were ultimately separated over the earth. Dan Landis documents other examples. In the Burmese legend, the people built a pagoda to try to reach the heavens, and their god came down angrily and confused their languages and caused them to spread out. In the Congo, instead of building a tower, the people balanced themselves on big poles. In the Mexican version, they built a tower out of clay. In India, it was demons, and they built an altar to the sky and were thwarted by the sky god. In Africa, in Greece, the Assam people, so many people have a story about a structure being built into the sky and the languages being confused so that the people were spread out. And as with the flood legends, the details don't match, but they wouldn't be expected to match since the traditions were passed down orally for centuries. If they did match, once again, we'd think there'd been some kind of collusion. But the common thread of an incident involving God, a tall structure, the confusion of languages is a common theme that would be predicted based on the flood model. And as a side note, we might also make the prediction about the languages of the earth. If evolution were true, just like with the origin of species, you'd predict one language as a starting point, a relation, as they say, through descent from a common ancestor. If Babel happened and God created new languages to cause humanity to spread out, as he commanded, then we would expect that there would be evidence that today's languages cannot be traced down to one, but that they would be grouped into families of languages that can be traced back to ancient originals, proto-languages, and they had that had no evidence of having evolved from each other. And in fact, there is evidence of that prediction as well. Language can be extremely difficult to sort out, and there is no consensus about it, apparently, between linguists. But there is evidence that the thousands of spoken languages today can be traced back to possibly fewer than 20 languages, possibly coinciding with the genealogies of Genesis 10, which seem to be laying out how the family clans spread out to fill the earth after Babel. Another interesting prediction as a bonus, Bill Cooper, in his book After the Flood, traces down the ancient genealogies of various cultures, like the Greeks and Romans, whose genealogies apparently can be traced all the way back to Japheth, with Jupiter being another name for Japheth. The Romans apparently deified Japheth, calling him the son of heaven and earth. In Roman mythology, Jupiter is the Roman equivalent of Zeus in Greek mythology. And notice that one of the sources that has the genealogy, Nennius 18, also has Javan and Elisha, the son and grandson of Japheth, in the biblical text. Cooper notes that in India, the Vedas mention Japheth as well, calling him Prajapati. Again, notice the similarity there. Keeping in mind that, again, genealogies would have been primarily oral for centuries. They had deified Japheth as well, calling him the Lord of creation. He also illustrates the genealogies of the Miaozu people of China, genealogies that were already intact before Christian missionaries appeared in China. And the similarities with the biblical text are stunning. In place of Adam is the Miaozu word for dirt, coinciding, I guess, with where Adam came from. And then notice the similarity. Dirt's son is Sethi, or Seti, and Seth, and then others that don't match up clearly until right before Noah, when you have Lamah corresponding to Lamech, and Nuah corresponding to Noah. The sons of Nuah are Lo-Han for Ham, Lo-Shin for Shem, Japhu, Japheth. The sons of Lo-Shin are Elon and Nagasher, so Elam and Asher. The sons of Lo-Han are Cusah and Meseh, so Cush and Mizraim. Then Japhu has Gomer, corresponding to Gomer in the Bible. So these similarities seem too great to pass off as a coincidence. And this kind of similarity would be predicted if the creation model is true. So, you know, the creation model is not scientific. It can't make any verifiable predictions. So you should believe that anytime anybody says that, right? This is just a sampling of those. You know, the creation model is very scientific. It's supported by the evidence. In fact, evidence that the evolutionary model struggles with. So Bill Nye and those like him are wrong. All right, give me another couple minutes here, highlight some DVDs for you, in case there's any of those left back there. I mentioned to you there's three main pillars of the Christian faith: the existence of God, inspiration of the Bible, deity of Christ. These are three DVDs addressing those subjects. So this is creation and evolution, kind of broken down, dinosaurs. This is a kind of a seminar DVD on the deity of Christ. And then this is on the inspiration of the Bible. Mike Houts is a member of the church, was an atheist, and was converted to the church. He's now is at NASA, has a PhD in nuclear engineering from MIT, and is at NASA and higher up in NASA. He's got people that work under him. And he does a seminar entitled Evolution is Religion, Not Science. He's not afraid, is he? He just puts it on out there. Answering Atheism is the DVD version of Kyle's book that I told you about, Christian's Guide to Refuting Modern Atheism. And then Always Be Ready is the teen version. This is the DVD of that. And we try to make these short enough where they could be used as Bible classes. Islam, my dad's seminar on looking at what is Islam, what is the Quran, who is Muhammad, how do you know the Quran is not inspired. His series on the silencing of God, the sequel seminar to that, is America's Most Pressing Concern. I think you guys had him for this a few years ago. Is the Bible reliable? This is the DVD version of Eric's books, the Anvil Ring series that I told you about, responding to all the alleged contradictions in the Bible. This is a DVD version So it looks at a lot of those and gives you those principles for how to deal with contradictions. Kyle has done 3 debates, taking on leading atheists, and these are those debates. This is a short DVD, 1 session, addressing the question, what about the separation of church and state? Is that what the founders intended with regard to government and religion? You know, this is one of the big questions people are having now. You know, some people say, well, you know, even if the Bible was originally inspired, it's not anymore because it's been transmitted, and along the way, since it's been transmitted by people that aren't inspired, it's been corrupted along the way. You don't have the original copies of any of the books. So how do you know the Bible's been transmitted and then translated faithfully? How can you know that? That's what this is about. It's a seminar, DVD on that subject. This is a new one that my dad did, Pleasing God in Worship. So looking at a lot of the changes going on in Churches of Christ and responding to some of these additions and adjustments being made in worship. This is the other seminar that I'm not doing this weekend. This is the other side of the coin, Systematically Dismantling Evolution. This is 8 sessions, about 35 minutes each. So we're talking, you know, somewhere around 4 hours. The actual seminar is probably more like 8 hours. So there's a lot more material in the actual version, but this kind of summarizes it for you anyway. This is not an AP product. Raise your hand if you've seen this movie. I'm just curious. Good. All right. This is, I think they've still got it on Netflix. This was actually put out in theaters, and the leading creation scientists in the world are the guys that are featured in this film. These are the guys I'm getting to go study with in the field, and go through the Grand Canyon with, and study seismites and whatever, caves. So those are the guys, and they're giving you a lot of awesome scientific evidence for the creation model. It's kind of the point of that. I highly recommend you get a copy of that and check it out. Very well done. In fact, since I rub elbows with those guys, they sent it to us at AP to review it and make any recommended changes before they went live with it to make sure that our audience would be cool with it. And so we actually did have some recommendations, which they changed, and so we feel real good about how that turned out. A year and a half ago, somewhere around 18 months ago, we put together a scientist seminar where I gathered together a lot of the brotherhood scientists that do writing for us at AP, and we did just a weekend seminar on dismantling evolution and then building the creation model very succinctly. So Joe DeWeese, member of the church, has a PhD in biochemistry. Michael Houts, who I just mentioned, Branyon May, who's the astrophysicist. Justin Rogers is a Hebrew scholar, teaches at Fried Hardeman. And so we just in that weekend got together and systematically dismantled evolution, each of us taking the area that's kind of our expertise and dismantling that element of the evolutionary model. So really neat seminar how that turned out. I'd highly recommend that. All right. Let's see. We have a couple audio books. If you don't have time to sit down and read, but you have a CD player and can listen in the car, we've got these 2 books available. A member of the church that does this professionally is reading these books. And then I told you about Digger Doug, which is our Christian Evidences show for kids. I think we have 1 or 2 more volumes that we're hoping to put out soon, and that'll pretty much wrap up that series. There'll be 22 or 24 episodes total. And then the final thing, this morning, I've lost track. I mentioned to you the memory verse list that I made for young people that I think they need to have memorized in preparation for discussions with their friends. Well, in order to make it easier for my little ones to memorize and little kids to start memorizing before they even get to those teen years, I started making some memory verse CDs that have tunes and rhythms and stuff. I've got quite a lot of music in my background. And so I started doing these to song to make it easier for kids to memorize. So this is the Old Testament, and this is the Gospels, Matthew through John. I've got like 50 passages with songs on that. Kids Prep is a CD I did, helping kids to memorize other things in Scripture that I think are important, from, you know, Ten Commandments and Beatitudes and the plagues and things like that that we normally like to memorize, but I like to have it to song. And I think that's one of the reasons why God has us get together and sing, is because it's hard to forget things when you sing them. You know, it just gets stuck in your head. And so I think it's interesting that he wants us to say sometimes the exact words out of Scripture, but just do it to a melody, and there's something about that that makes it harder to forget. But I tell you, I've got some stuff in here on just helping kids even memorize, you know, what is a chapter summary of Genesis and Matthew and Acts, where, you know, they know what occurs in each chapter, and there's one for the entire Bible. Whenever you ask a kid, okay, where do you turn in your Bible? You know, ask, you know, Campbell here who's sleeping. You know, where do you turn in your Bible if you want to read about where the Israelites were allowed to come out of captivity and restore the walls of Jerusalem? Right? Many of us wouldn't be able to answer that. You're able to go back to Jerusalem, restore the walls of Jerusalem. Well, whenever they answer what? Anybody know? Nehemiah. Whenever they answer Nehemiah, cool. You know, I wouldn't have known that as a kid. So what I did is take a lot of that kind of stuff and put those to rhythms and songs. And we actually do that on our Sunday nights before worship. We get the kids together, actually the whole congregation together. They're just there to support, but really they're learning it too, you know. But the kids are all learning all this stuff. Christian Evidences, this is basically all the verses that I basically quote in this seminar that have to do with Christian Evidences, memorizing all those. So they're very relevant to Christian Evidences, as well as some other songs that kind of help you memorize other important keys, that sort of thing. So it's aimed at kids, you know, it's not really, you know, I wouldn't really probably sing some of these songs to adults, but hey, let me tell you, I use them myself to try to memorize. In fact, sometimes when I quote a passage, I got to stop and remember, how does that song go? You know, kind of quote it to myself. Very helpful. All right, so in our session tomorrow morning, we're going to look at the last plank on that tower we're building, and that is the creation model robust? Can it withstand scrutiny? So we're going to look at a lot of the major arguments that people have tried to make against the biblical model and show, or at least against the biblical story, and show that the model that I've laid out is able to withstand those attacks to where the biblical creation model can be shown to be valid. Our final session then will be, okay, now what? Who cares about all that? You know, what does all that matter? Why would you want to become a Christian? Kind of looking at that question, which of course is where all this is pointed. You want to try to convert people, and that's what we'll look at in that final session. All right, man, this is a lot of material, I know. It's harder on me because I got to stand up here and actually say it. You guys get to take a nap and whatnot. So, but I didn't really see a lot of that, so that's good, except for him. He's over here napping. But he's heard this so many times, he could probably quote it too. Anyway, I appreciate very much your attention.